civil government and the church. Now we'll talk about the church and the old covenant, or the old and new covenants, as they are classified as one institution, but they're, of course, two entirely separate things. What Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 13 here is civil government, that second institution. And as I laid the groundwork this morning, whether you had realized it or not, it was for this service tonight. And this morning we talked about the fact that back in the Old Testament, God introduced civil government in response for one of the great crises that the world had faced. We talked about several of those. Of course, the Garden of Eden and the fall in the Garden of Eden, and of course, then there was the time of the patriarchs after the flood, and then there was, of course, the dispensation of the church, and each of these dispensations began with a judgment, and the judgment was preceded, of course, by this great crisis and failure of mankind. Well, we find that civil government now was instituted after that great crisis that brought the flood forth, and the flood being the judgment, and then that new age that started after that. And with that new age now, God introduces civil government. And I think it might be instructive to go back and look at that. And of course, it's found in Genesis chapter 9. So let's go there. Genesis chapter 9. Now, as Genesis chapter 9 opens, we find now that Noah and his have disembarked from the ark, and God now speaks and blesses Noah. And as we pick it up in verse number 1, we read, "And God blessed Noah and his sons, and said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, and upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you, even as the green herb have I given you all things. But the flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, ye shall not eat. And surely your blood of your lives will I require, at the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man, and the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. And you, be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth, and multiply therein." Okay, as soon as they've stepped off the ark now, God immediately begins to lay down the rules for this new age that they have just come into. Now, we'll notice that in the first couple of verses, God reiterates something that he has said before. And of course, it has to do with the family. So in verse number 1, we see that God blesses Noah and his sons, his family, and says unto them, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth." And so we see that the institution of the family and the reason that the family was instituted is reiterated here. That hasn't changed. But there are some new strictures here. Now we know that before the flood, men did not eat meat, at least so far as we know. It wasn't sanctioned by God if they did. And so now, after the flood, we find that that sanction has been removed, and men are allowed now to eat meat, to eat animals, but there are some conditions that are placed upon that. So once again, the first thing that we see here, the first thing, as soon as they get off the ark, before anything else is accomplished, God lays down these things. And he says, okay, I want the family to continue. He instituted the family, and he intends for the family to continue throughout the course of human history. Now, of course, there's coming a time when the family won't be necessary anymore, because there'll only be one family and not families, and there'll be no further need for procreation. But until that time happens, the institution of the family, which was, by the way, instituted for the very reason of procreation, why, God says that is also to continue. All right, the next thing that's said is that they are allowed to consume meat. However, there is a stricture along with that, and we find that in verse number 4. But the flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, ye shall not eat. Now, this is the first time that we find this stricture mentioned. Blood is not to be eaten. Well, why is that? Is there a hint in verse number 4 as to why that might be? Why would God sanction the eating of blood, but allow the eating of the flesh of the animal? Because of the life. God never gives up his claim on life. God is the author of life, and he's about to transfer into the hands of man a civil government that he's about to constitute. But civil government is not to have control over life. And so the first principle that we see here is that as far as externals go, man is going to be allowed to have a realm of influence, but as far as life itself, God retains his exclusive right. Okay, pressing on then. Verse number 5. Because of that, God says, and surely your blood of your lives will I require, at the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Why? It's right there, after the colon. For in the image of God made he man. God is the author of life, and man is never given control over that. Now, somebody is going to say, but he just gave the power of the sword to this newly instituted human government. Remember, I talked about the external sphere of man's existence and the internal? That's going to become very important as we develop this idea, this theme of human government, because human government was constituted to have a certain sphere of activity, and they weren't to go beyond that sphere. So far as the outward physical construct of human society, civil government was to have control. But over the internal workings of man, over his soul and spirit, this human government was to have no control. And though the human government was given the power of the sword to shed man's blood in response for man shedding man's blood, that did not extend to control over his soul. That's an important distinction to make. Because some, if they don't understand that, are going to look at what happens when Peter is commanded not to preach in the name of Jesus. And Peter's response was, whether we should obey God or man in this matter, we'll leave that for you to decide. And they continued to preach the gospel. Now, who was it that told them and commanded them that they should not preach in this name? It was human government. This institution that gets started here in Genesis chapter 9, they are the ones, and using the power of government, they said, we forbid you to preach in this name, with the implied threat that if they did, their lives would be taken from them. Okay. Do you see a problem here? Sure, somebody's going to say, well, wait a minute. They were disobeying the laws of man. And we're going to find out when we get into Romans chapter 13 here that there's an apparent difficulty there. How is it that in one place, certain say that they don't have to obey the commands of men, and then in other places we're told to obey the commands of men? It looks like there's a dichotomy here, but we're going to find out that there's really not when we start looking beyond the surface in this matter. Okay, back to verse number 5. And surely your blood of your lives will I require, not the human government, I will require it. Remember, God never gives up his exclusive claim as being the author of all life. He never bequeaths any control over that thing to any other created being. That's his provenance. So what's he saying here in verse number 5? And surely your blood of your lives will I require at the hand of every beast, will I require it at the hand of man, and at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. So he's talking about the instrumentality here of how it's to be brought about. It's God that will control it, but now he bequeaths into the hands of man the right to carry out his sentence. Does that make sense? It's very important that we understand this difference, or this distinction, if you will. And of course, verse number 6 points that out. So what does verse number 5 establish? And what does verse number 6 establish? It establishes man carrying out capital punishment, and by extension, of course, punishment for those things that are considered lesser crimes. So here we have granted into the hands of man now this new area of authority, if you will. And it isn't man's authority, it's man exercising God's authority as his viceroys. So human government is to be the viceroy of God. Well, this is a great power, and this is something that did not exist before the flood. Now, what was the problem that resulted in this great crisis that led to the flood? Was it not the fact that there was no retarding force in the antediluvian age to hold back the bulwarks of sin, as it were? People just did whatever they jolly well wanted to, and might became right. And so, how did that end up?
Not too well.
Not too well at all. When God looked at it, he said there isn't any redeeming quality to any of this. Only Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. When you consider what must have been the size and extent of the antediluvian world, this is quite something where the crisis brings it down to one of the race of Adam that finds grace in the eyes of the Lord. And so there needs to be some sort of a retarding force to delay the growth and exercise of evil. Now, God knows that this little I hesitate to call it an experiment because it's his institution, but it really is, so far as man is concerned, an experiment in human government. God knows that it's going to ultimately fail because anything that's granted into the hands of man, they always destroy because man is fallen. He's incapable of governing himself. He proved that in the Garden of Eden. And then by successive experiment in the antediluvian world, he proved it over and over until the whole world was corrupt in the sight of God. So why did God institute human government?
To try to stop some of this stuff.
Yes, to retard the growth and proliferation of evil. Not to stop it, because it can't be stopped. And since God knew it couldn't be stopped, why did he bother with this exercise?
To show us that we couldn't do it ourselves.
That's the purpose of each of the dispensations, is to show man that without him, they can do nothing. Without Christ, we can do nothing. And so man goes through these periods to show man himself. It doesn't show God anything. He already knew all these things. But it's a warning to man that you need me because you're not capable of governing yourself. So one of two things has to change. Either I step in and govern you by the power of the sword, which is exactly what's going to happen during the millennium. It would not be a wise thing to step out of line during the millennium. Or what if man could be born again? What if he could be regenerated? Well, wouldn't that be the best answer? It certainly would. Well, men today have that opportunity. It's always nice to have options. There you go. Okay, so God said then that civil government is his institution, and man and civil government act as his agents in carrying out this business of capital punishment here. So could you very safely say at this point in the scripture, and we're only, what, 9 chapters into the book, God is saying that capital punishment is something that he not only approves of but commands? I'm just pausing here to let this sink in because somebody's thinking, but wait, that's not what the society around us is saying. We have to rehabilitate.
Kill the babies, not the murderers.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Let's go back to our reading then in chapter 13. So now with what we have just looked into, let's read this passage having to do with civil government here, because this is going to be very important to a Christian. And isn't it interesting that he's writing to the church at Rome, which even in the time that Paul writes this was already thoroughly corrupt? They're not going to have to go to the time of Caligula and Nero. They're already corrupt before Paul ever comes onto the scene. Remember that Paul is writing this letter to the church at Rome when in very recent history, the Roman proconsul has put Christ to death, Pontius Pilate. So you would expect Paul to have some pretty keen insight into what civil government should and shouldn't do. Let's do some reading, shall we? Romans 13 then, beginning in verse number 1. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. Now, be paying attention as we're reading this. It's not just an exercise. We want to learn something from it. Verse 4, for he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou doest that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore, you must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience's sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to who custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Owe no man anything but to love one another, for if he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. For this, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. And that, knowing that the time that now it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, and not in strife and envying. But put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. Now, if you had been a believer in this time, you might have a different view of what civil government is and why it was constituted than, let's say, a 1950s American citizen might have. Because we're approaching a time in the life of our country when a lot of believers are having the same sorts of thoughts about civil government as these people would have had, which is the reason that Paul includes chapter 13 in this book that he writes to the church at Rome for the Christians that lived at Rome. Now, once again, what was the object of God's experiment, if we dare put it that way, in civil government in Genesis chapter 9? What was the idea of it once again?
Well, to be a deterrent to you.
Yes. Yes, to impede the progress of evil. What do you suppose would have happened in the post-diluvian world had God not instituted civil government?
Probably just would have gone back the way it was.
Very, very quickly. As a matter of fact, really it does. Even in the history of Israel, as we move on now in the book of Genesis, we begin to take up the history of Israel. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their descendants. And by this time, God now has instituted his third institution, the Old Covenant, and then the New Covenant. And look how they acted under that. Strategic pause to let us think about this just for a moment. So even though God has instituted civil government, does everything suddenly work like it's supposed to? There's suddenly no killings, no robberies.
Very little sanctification process.
Pardon?
It's always a down spiral.
Of course it is. So the idea of human government wasn't to stop this.
No.
As a matter of fact, we're going to find out in Paul's time, and long before Paul's time, human government actually becomes complicit in it. And this is what's confusing Americans today, because Americans would have had Paul's idea in Romans chapter 13 here in the 1950s or before that. Government is a good thing because it punishes evildoers. It's restraining evil in our society. But many Christians today are now becoming perplexed. Well, wait a minute. It seems like government has joined the forces of evil, and it's become a worse force for evil than what the world would be without government. It's being used as a force to propagate evil. This is a great conundrum for Christians. And there's a couple of different takes on this. There's the sort of turn the other cheek take on this. Whatever government says, you're supposed to do it because government is always right, because it's God's institution, and therefore you're supposed to subject yourself because these powers are instituted by God, and it would be very wicked for you to speak against them or, for heaven's sake, to physically resist.
But that goes against what Jesus said, it rendered to God that which is the yes.
You're picking this up with Rod. You're trying to skip ahead a few chapters.
It's so wonderfully basic what you're saying.
It is, but you're supposed to be an ambassador that's able to explain these things to people because they don't understand. They've heard just enough of the Bible to be dangerous. And so one of the views out there is the one that I just expounded. And the other view is that all government is inherently evil, and so therefore anything that they're really up to is just a cover for their ulterior motives, and they're just absolutely worthless people that are just out for themselves, and so therefore, off with their heads. Oh, wait a minute, it was the Queen that said that. Maybe I should rephrase that. Yes, let them eat cake. So you see, it's possible to have a completely unbalanced view. And by the way, those two views are neither one biblical. So we have to understand what Paul really is trying to say here. Well, that's what we're going to attempt to do over the course of the next several lessons. What side should we be on here? Well, I don't think we want to be identified with those that say, well, we just turn the other cheek, and if the government says that abortion is okay, well, maybe we don't have to become abortionists, but we're certainly not supposed to withhold our tax money. We're told to pay tribute, to pay custom. And so therefore, we're supposed to support that because to do that would be resisting the higher powers. Can you see that this is a great place of confusion for Christians? What should we do? Well, maybe there's this other way of, hey, let's shoot an abortionist. Now, if you're queasy, you don't have to be up close. There are techniques. So which of those is correct? Because if you shoot the abortionist, you just usurped God's institution of human government. You just took it into your hands. You've said that you were supposed to be the one that pulled the trigger. Maybe you could just use a... Yes, maybe you could hire somebody else to do it for you. Yeah, there we go. There's always a solution if you think it through. I'm just being facetious. But you can see how there's a great deal of confusion around this. What should a Christian actually think? Well, Paul is telling us here. Paul is not telling us to be complicit in the evil of government. And if I might leave you just before we go to the Lord's table with this one thought. On Calvary's brow, there were three crosses. What was a common element that bound two of them together?
They were up there for the crimes they committed.
Yes, they were. One wasn't, but two were. Did the Roman government exercise its lawfully constituted power? They might have gone about it in a more humane way, but they did. What about in the case of Jesus? Certainly not. That's something to think about. Some people would say two out of three ain't bad. I'm just kidding about that. But you can see, just from looking at that little scene here, there's something to think about. There's some food for thought. And sure enough, in subsequent lessons, we'll do a little thinking about that. But as for now, let's bow our heads.